We're in Matthew chapter 5 this morning, and we'll be looking at verses 38 to 42. Just invite you to stand with me as we read our text this morning. Out of reverence for God's word, let's stand as we hear the word together. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 38. We'll go ahead and read down to the end of the chapter. So follow along as we read God's word. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans also? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. This is the word of the Lord. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. You may be seated. I want to get you started today with some inspiring quotes sourced from top sources on Google. Here you go. This is a good quote. You can put this on a plaque, hang it in your living room, sell it at Hobby Lobby. I don't get mad, I get even. Or I've heard it this way. I don't get even, I get ahead. There's another one. I don't hold grudges, I remember facts. Or here's another one I saw. May God have mercy on my enemies because I won't. How many of you have heard these before, these quotes about getting even and about revenge, about retaliation? We kind of chuckle because we kind of know deep down we're not supposed to respond that way, right? But in our heart of hearts, we all want to respond that way. Man, when somebody hits you, you're like, I'm going to hit them back. And I'm going to hit them so hard they never want to hit me back again, right? Or somebody hurls an insult at me. Well, I'm going to come back with a comeback that will leave them stammering to come back with a reply. Whatever you want to call it, revenge, retaliation, getting your pound of flesh, getting even. When we are wronged, is it not natural to try to sort of balance the scales of justice by getting back at the people who harm us? You can define revenge or retaliation as the urge to exact retribution for an injustice or wrong committed by another person by inflicting hurt or harm on them. They hurt me, and so I'm going to hurt them. This really resonates because you think of all of the works of literature that have sort of revenge as kind of the central motif. You remember reading the Count of Monte Cristo in literature class or in high school? A whole story is about getting revenge decades later. Or you can think about Hamlet or Gladiator or any number of sort of movies or shows or works of literature, that the whole story is about somebody has wronged me and I'm going to have my revenge. I mean, let's admit it. There is something really, really deeply satisfying, right? When the person who made you suffer is made to suffer the same thing, preferably at your own hands, to be like, see, how do you like that? Something deeply satisfying in a story when the protagonist finally gets even with the antagonist. When the bad guy has to suffer what he inflicted on the good guy. And you ask the question, what is underlying this desire we have for revenge? On one level, you could say there's sort of a good impulse here, right? We have a sense that there is such a thing as right and wrong and justice and injustice. And when an injustice has been done, we're like, man, the scales, the cosmic scales need to be balanced, and I want to be the one to put my finger on that side of the scale. On one level, it reflects the fact that we are made in the image of God, and it reflects the reality that we have a recognition, a sense of right and wrong. But here's the problem. A lot of times, The alarm only gets tripped when the wrong is done towards us. And a lot of times, if not always, when we want revenge, the desire is, I want to be the one to carry it out because I was the one that was wronged, and it is driven by a sense of hurt, pride, or personal pain rather than any kind of concern for justice. So there is a correct sense that there must be justice. That is true. Paired with the idea that I must be the one to carry it out, which is not true. We do it because it feels good to us. We pursue revenge because it makes us feel vindicated, gives us the moral high ground to be able to hurl lightning bolts and rocks down on those who have wronged us. It is driven by really a profound sense of self-righteousness and pride that I must be judge, jury, and executioner because I can't really trust God to carry out justice. Now, we often think of revenge in sort of like big feuds, like the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? Or we're commemorating 30 years since the genocide in Rwanda, where the Hutsis and the Tutsis and the Hutsis had a massive genocidal war with each other over a matter of just a couple of months, killed 800,000 people. You think about, man, these ethnic struggles that have happened and these deep hatreds. We think of revenge often in those terms, but think of all of the petty ways that we try to take out revenge on other people. Just in your marriage. Your spouse ignores you in a conversation, so you're like, well, I'll see how they like that, so I'm just not going to say anything, or I'm just going to kind of grunt when they say something my way. How do you like that when I don't reply to you? Or your coworker doesn't help you with a project, so when he comes along and says, hey, would you help me? You're like, nope, not going to help him because he didn't help me. Feels so good to be able to get even in that kind of way. Or somebody you're mad at, instead of answering their questions, I'm just going to use one-word answers. How are you today? Fine. What did you do at work today? Worked. And so just a little way where verbally I'm going to get even with them because of something they might have done earlier in the day. My point is, revenge can run on a spectrum from genocidal rage and attacks that we saw in Rwanda 30 years ago to just petty little verbal missiles that are hurled or withheld towards your spouse. You see, as natural as getting even feels, Jesus commands his people to not get even. He says, you've heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This idea of get even when something's done wrong, balance the scales of justice instead. Resist not evil. He's telling his followers, you must not get even. You're like, that's shocking. That feels wrong. It feels unjust. As natural as it getting even feels, Jesus commands us as his followers not to do it. And that in and of itself is pretty odd. I'm calling this message being odd about getting even. Now, there's plenty of people today, and you go on to sort of into therapy culture, people will say, you know what, revenge is sort of psychologically harmful for you. So there's better things that you can do, like just block people who are toxic and stay away from them, or the best way to get revenge on someone is to move on with your life and be happy and succeed. And there's some truth in that, right? Like, okay, fine, move on with your life. Don't dwell on it. But Jesus calls us to go even beyond that. Initially, he says, turn the other cheek. He goes on to say, go the second mile. Give not just your coat, but your cloak also. The rest of the chapter that we read, that you're going to even bless those who hate you. In Romans 12 that we read earlier, avenge not yourself, but give place to wrath. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him to drink. Jesus is saying, not only am I telling you don't take revenge, but I'm actually commanding you to positively love and serve and invest in those who wrong you. You say, wow, that's an impossible standard. That's something I don't think I can do on my own, which is why we need the gospel, which is why we need what we just sang about, amazing love, how can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me to motivate us to live that way. Jesus calls us to be odd about getting even. He calls us to have a righteousness, back in verse 20, that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. He's not just calling us to ordinary, average level goodness of like, hey, just go see what everyone else is doing and match that. He's saying, no, you as my people, you must have a way of life, an ethic that exceeds that of the culture around you, an ethic that exceeds that of even the religious scribes and Pharisees. This idea that you need to do more than what other people do. If you're simply doing what everyone else does, there's nothing special about that. So what does real righteousness look like? Okay, that, remember, that's what we're dealing with back in verse 20. Accept your righteousness, shall exceed that. And then he's contrasting real righteousness with the false interpretations of the scribes and Pharisees. So you get, you've heard that it was said, don't commit murder. He's saying real righteousness goes beyond that. He says, you have heard, don't commit adultery. Real righteousness goes beyond that. You have heard, but I say unto you. He's continuing on with these contrasts. Ye have heard, verse 38, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What does real righteousness look like when it is wronged? You see, the test of your righteousness, the test of your heart is not when you're having a great day, right? Take, for example, your commitment to fitness is not measured by the days that you're like really motivated and want to go to the gym. The test of your commitment to fitness is the day that you don't really feel like doing it. The same is true with our righteousness. The test of your righteousness and your commitment to Jesus is not what you do when you wake up and everything's feeling great and everybody loves you and the birds are singing and the sun is shining and you're like, I want to follow Jesus and I just am overflowing with praise. The test of your righteousness, how real it is what you do when you are wronged. What you do when you don't get your way. What you do when you are maligned and attacked. So Jesus gives us five concrete examples. Let me just say this up front. We would be misinterpreting Jesus to say he's giving us a comprehensive rule book for life. There are some people who have done this. So the Anabaptists, for example, took this to say absolutely no self-defense whatsoever during the kind of the 1500s. They were like, it is wrong to carry any kind of a weapon. And if anything attacks you, if anybody tries to harm you, you just take it. You don't ever defend yourself. That was this ethic of non-retaliation. There's people today who hold that, like the Mennonites and the Amish would hold that belief of absolutely no serving in the military, no serving in the police force, nothing that involves resisting evil. That's not what Jesus is aiming at. He's not saying, here is a verse that you can lift out of context that now is an all-encompassing rule for every sphere of life. He's dealing specifically with how we respond to when we are attacked for the cause of Christ. So five examples that are fleshing out a single principle. So how do we respond? Well, let's just break this down here. We start off first off considering how do we respond to broken teeth. Ye have heard has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, Jesus is simply quoting from the Old Testament here. The Pharisees were simply taking some phrases from the Old Testament that were talking about how the law was to be administered. This is the famous principle of lex talionis, the law of sort of retaliation, proportional retribution. The Pharisees of Jesus' day, however, had read these as a permission or even a command that when somebody does you wrong, you can do them wrong in return to sort of balance the scales of justice. They read these as personal permission to go get retribution and get revenge. They took it as get even always. Don't let anyone get away with disrespecting you or stealing from you. Teach them a lesson. But that actually misses the original point of these verses. In their original context, we're dealing with the law that God gave to Israel, and it was not about personal revenge. Rather, it was about judicial sentencing. Jesus is not denying that. He is saying, you guys have taken these commands that had to do with how the community responds, how the nation responds to injustice. Hey, if somebody kills someone, there's going to be capital punishment. All right? Now, that's not you in a vigilante way going and saying, I'm going to go take their life. But no, rather, that is something that is done sort of through due process, and there are witnesses, and as a result, there is a death sentence that's carried out dispassionately, not in a fit of rage. The point of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was to set limits on the kind of punishments that could be exacted. Here's how things would often happen in the ancient world. Somebody disrespects your cousin, and you say, I can't believe they disrespected my cousin. So you go and you punch them in the face. Escalation. Well, their clan comes back around and says, well, you punched my cousin in the face. So now they come and they burn down your house. And so you respond and say, we're going to burn down their village, where there is just this vigilante justice where rather than saying, hey, we're going to do this in a way that is equitable, it became, we're going to do it in a way that is escalating to more and more spirals of violence out of control. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was meant to put a limit and a cap on excessive punishment where you stole some wheat from the king, we're going to kill you. No, that is handled in a way that is equitable, in a way where the punishment fits the crying. So for one thing, the Pharisees are completely missing the original point. And Jesus is not denying that there is a rightful place for a society to have laws and to have enforcement mechanisms. In fact, the rest of the New Testament notes that. Romans 13 says that the point of government is to bear the sword and to ensure that there is justice and that people are protected. 1 Peter chapter 2 makes the same point. But there is an enormous amount of difference between me taking the law into my own hands and recognizing God has ordained the state to have the law in its hands. I am not the one who bears the sword, but Caesar is the one who bears the sword. The Pharisees had misread this. Many today have misread this, that my personal ethic is an eye for an eye. No. That is not a personal ethic. That is a statement of justice that is meant to be held by the community. Now, the Jewish people rightly recognized that that language was not meant to be literally cut people's hands off. That's how it's practiced in Saudi Arabia, for example. But rather to say punishments need to meet the severity of the crime. So if there is a fine, it needs to sort of match the kind of punishment that was given or the crime that was committed. If there's a prison sentence, it should match the severity, and so on. So Jesus is not rejecting that legal principle. He is rejecting turning it into an excuse for personal vengeance. So notice what he says in verse 39. But I say unto you, okay, you've heard from the law as filtered through the Pharisees that revenge or retribution is great. Go ahead and get even. He says, no. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. Wow, he's stating it very baldly and very directly. What does he mean by that shocking phrase, resist not evil? I mentioned a minute ago there's people who take this to say you should never, ever, ever resist evil in any form. A guy named Leo Tolstoy, right, the famous Russian novelist, he studied the Sermon on the Mount, and he was like, this means you should never resist evil ever. There should be no military, there should be no police, everybody should just get along with each other. About a year ago, we were on vacation, I was checking into a hotel, and as I'm checking in, there's a guy behind me in the lobby who is just hurling verbal abuse at the girl at the counter. He's threatening her with violence. She's visibly shaken, in tears, absolutely terrified that he's going to come. And like, it sounded like he was on the verge of physically attacking her because his check-in didn't go the way that he wanted. And so I just made it a point to keep myself between him and her. And I said, I'm going to stay here till the police arrive. And the police came and took him off. Was I wrong to resist evil in that moment? To stand between this evil, violent, dangerous person and someone who's just trying to do their job? Guys like Tolstoy would say, yeah, you should have just walked out of there and let whatever was going to go down, go down. That is not what Jesus is talking about. When he says, resist not evil, he is not saying, let evil run rampant. In fact, this same word that's translated resist is the same word that is used in James that says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. The same word that's used in 1 Peter to say, resist Satan, right? To actively resist the very personification of evil we ought to resist. We ought to resist evil in our own hearts. We ought to resist evil in society. The Bible is clear that governments should punish evil as a way to restrain man's wicked heart. The Bible is clear, Psalm 82, verses 3 and 4, Proverbs 31, 8 and 9, that the righteous king is one who defends the fatherless and defends the weak, who defends those who are oppressed by the violent. Like, that is a mark of godliness. What Jesus means, and actually what the Greek is very clear on, and if you have a modern translation, brings this out, resist not the evil person. All right? So we should resist evil in all of its forms. The idea here is resist not the evil individual who is trying to do you harm directly. In the context, what does Jesus mean? Do not retaliate. That's what that phrase means. Resist not evil. Resist not the evil person. Do not retaliate. Do not take the law into your own hands. Don't say, well, they harmed me. I'm going to harm them in return. I'm going to plot my revenge. I'm not only going to get even, I'm going to get ahead. He says, don't demand an eye for an eye. Don't demand, don't nurse a grudge. Don't feed your bitterness. Don't plot your revenge. The question we have to ask ourselves is this. How do you respond when you are mistreated? It's the idea, well, they mistreated me, so now I'm going to mistreat them. Jesus says, no, resist not the evil person. Don't go out to get even. How do you react when you don't get your way? How do you react when someone gets credit for your work? So, well, I'm going to make sure I run them down a little bit to kind of make sure that... How, How do you react when your spouse doesn't thank you for some sacrifice that you made? How do you react when an unkind word is hurled your way? How do you react when you're sort of driving down I-10 and somebody cuts you off right in front of you? That reveals your heart, right? How you react in those moments reveals what is really going on in the depths of your heart. You say, well, I just got angry because of the situation. No, the situation simply drew out what was already in your heart. Is your response to say, I'm going to get even and I'm going to let them have it? Resist not evil. Again, understanding resist not evil. We're not talking about self-defense here in a dangerous situation. We're talking about the impulse to go out and get even. The impulse to go out and say, I'm going to get my revenge. I'm going to retaliate. So how do you respond to broken teeth? Not by demanding that the other person get their teeth broken as well. Jesus says, no, 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 that is not a personal ethic. That's the standard for the law, for society. Yes, there should be proportional justice and all of those things. But personally, individually, as a follower of Jesus, I may not pursue a vendetta. I must not seek revenge. Now, he breaks this down even more by giving us four sort of rapid-fire examples. Again, not a comprehensive law for every area of life, but concrete examples that help us see the principle in action. Verse 39 continues, hey, resist not the evil person, but whosoever will smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. How do we respond to stinging insults? Now, let me explain this a little bit. Some of you are like, well, that's someone just punched you in the face. That's not an insult. The word that is used here is used consistently in the New Testament for an open-handed slap in the face. Slap in the face is not fatal. Okay, this is not somebody showing up with a 12-gauge shotgun and sticking it in your face and saying, give me your keys. This is someone slapping you in the face. And the idea of if they slap you on the right cheek, if most people are right-handed, that means it was a backhanded slap. The rabbi said this, a backhanded slap is twice as disrespectful as an open-handed slap. So the idea here is this is a slap that is meant to say, you're nothing, and I'm going to just push you around, and I'm going to treat you like dirt. It has more to do with wounding your pride than wounding your body. We have to understand the culture, the society we're dealing with to be able to interpret this. Remember, the Bible is written to its original audience before it is written to us. We've got to understand, what would this have meant to Jesus' original hearers? They would have understood this, a smite on the right cheek, as someone who is just treating you like garbage. Let me give you some examples. In 1 Kings, there's a prophet named Micaiah. He's given the task of coming before the king and delivering God's message. And he basically tells them the king is going to die in battle. And someone who's nearby the prophet comes and just slaps him in the face. Says, how dare you say that? It's basically saying, you are a heretic. You are not giving the message that we want you to give. And of course, Micaiah was a true prophet of God. He's being treated as a heretic, even though he is the only one in that situation is doing what is right. In Job 16, verse 10, Job describes the suffering that he is undergoing. And he mentions the fact that he is being taunted, he is being ridiculed, and he is having his face slapped. Again, I don't know if that was literally happening to him, but the point being, the slap in the face is about an insult. It is about in the ancient culture that was very much about shame and honor, was almost like the ultimate insult was to slap somebody in the face or spit on them, right? Most of us would recognize somebody spits on you unless they have some horrible disease. That's not a threat to my life. But it does show absolute disdain for my person or my position. In Acts 23, verse 2, Paul is standing before the Sanhedrin, and he says, I've lived in a good conscience before God, and the person standing next to him comes and smites him in the mouth, saying, how dare you say that? Again, a way of rebuking, a way of insulting. And all these contexts suggest this kind of behavior was done when somebody is regarded as a heretic. One scholar says, this is the heretic's slap. So the idea here is if someone smites thee on the right cheek, this is someone treating you with absolute disdain because of your faithfulness to Jesus Christ. That's what it means. The stinging insult that expresses utter disdain, even hatred for you. So we are not dealing with a life-threatening assault, but a pride-wounding insult. That's the difference. Okay, so we can't take this and say there's no place for self-defense. That's not what is being dealt with here. The other thing I would add, look again at verse 39, Whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek. Okay, that is singular. This is not you're standing there and someone attacks your wife. Well, you're just going to stand by and say, I'm not going to resist evil. This is an attack on me as a person, not an attack on some third party. This is not a homicidal maniac trying to kill your wife or a terrorist trying to kill your fellow citizens. This is someone who is insulting, perhaps even harming you as an individual. So what do you do in that situation? Jesus says, if someone does that to you, what is the reaction if somebody were to slap you in the face? You're walking through Walmart, someone sees you there from church, and they're like, man, I hate Christians, and they go up and they just slap you in the face. Your reaction naturally would be, let me just clock them into the next county, right? Or if your arm to be like, this is a time for me to utilize the Second Amendment. Like, that would be our natural impulse. The pride and the anger rising up in your heart would be like, it is time to give them what they gave me and really let them have it. Jesus says, no. When you are mistreated like that, what do? You turn the other cheek. You absorb the blow and you refuse to respond. That is like an incredibly unnatural thing to do, to get clocked in the face and to say, I am not going to react. I'm going to get smacked in the face for the cause of Christ and I am not going to respond in kind. I'm going to absorb it. I'm going to absorb the shame. I'm going to absorb the dishonor. I'm going to absorb the sting. I'm even going to absorb the physical injury and not retaliate. You see, while the law of Lex Talionis would say, you have the right to take the other person to the law and exact revenge, Jesus says, you don't. You turn the other cheek. You swallow your pride. You give up your rights because guess what? When you became a Christian, you took up your cross to follow Jesus. You died to the right to yourself. When your pride and your anger rises, die to yourself. When the instinct is to pull the gun out of your pocket and blow them away, die to yourself. Now, why do we do this? We do this because of the example of Christ. There is nothing extraordinary about someone hitting you and you just hitting them back. The loss to do that. You don't have to be a Christian to do that. There is something extraordinary about getting hit in the face, and in spite of the fact you say, I am strong enough to like knock the person into the next time zone, I'm not going to do it. That is something that is profoundly Christ-like. There's nothing Christ-like about responding in kind. There's nothing special about reacting and treating people the way they treat you. This is how our Lord himself behaved. Isaiah 50 verse 6 says, I gave my back to the smiters and my cheek to those who plucked out the beard. Wasn't Jesus being weak when he was mocked? It was Jesus saying, I could call legions of angels at this moment, but because of my obedience to the Father, I'm going to absorb it. Just over a few pages to Matthew 26, we see Jesus literally living this out. Matthew 26, verse 67. So here's Jesus before Caiaphas, and he has been condemned. Verse 67, then did they spit in his face and buffeted him. And others smote him with the palms of their hands, slapping him in the face, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is it he that smote thee? And Jesus does not react. There's something marvelous about that. Maybe the people in the moment wouldn't have acknowledged it, but Pilate marveled that Jesus did not stand up to try to defend himself. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 23, says of Jesus, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. The implication being that is not just how Jesus is meant to live. That is how Jesus' followers are meant to live. Refusing to retaliate is not a sign of weakness. Just, well, they'll do it again. Maybe they will. But you're being obedient to Jesus. It is a sign of strength. Jesus' silence before his accusers revealed his divine dignity and his grace. In a way, if he just got angry and hit them back, wouldn't have been anything unique. Are you feeling at this point like that doesn't sound natural, that doesn't sound normal? You're feeling that you're getting the force of what Jesus is saying. So it feels sort of un-American and like I feel like, let it. No. We're called to be like Christ. Now, most of us probably won't be slapped in the face this week because of our obedience to Christ. Most of us won't be sort of threatened because we're following Jesus. You might be. Most of us probably won't. But chances are most of us will have a temptation this week to try to get even on some in some petty kind of ways. So you say, for example, you're texting a friend and your friend doesn't text back right away. The next day he texts you and you're like, well, I'm going to see how he likes sort of being left hanging for a while. Like, just give him a little bit of his own medicine, just so he can kind of learn. Maybe your husband is a bit of a slob, right? Like, just leaves clothes all over the place and never puts the dishes away. So you're like, you know what? I'm just going to show him what this is like. I'm going to refuse to do any housework until he pulls his weight around here. Just a little way to get even. Or your buddy consistently shows up late for golf. Well, next time I'm going to show up late to the thing he wants me to be at, just so he can see how it feels. A lot of sin gets justified because we get wronged. Your partner cheats on you, so you're like, well, I guess I'll cheat on them. That's the logic of the world. That's the logic of the devil. Your friend runs you down, or the person you thought was your friend runs you down. You justify, well, since they did it to me, now it is open season. I'm going to run them down. What if instead you turned the other cheek? What if instead you say, I'm going to absorb the wrong myself and I am not going to retaliate in kind? In some tiny little way, you're being like Jesus in that moment. You're being like the one who absorbed blows because of your sin. You're being like the one who took the shame and the spitting because of your iniquity. You're being like the one who bore the wrath of God that you deserved. Challenging stuff, isn't it? We move on to the next statement. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. Here we see how the greater righteousness of the disciple of Jesus responds to injustice. The idea here, we got this word coat and this word cloak. The word translated coat here actually refers to the tunic that would have been worn next to the skin. Right, so it's sort of the basic garment they would have worn in that day. The word that's translated cloak is referring to the outer robe. You sort of picture, you know, the kind of the bathrobe idea that you picture people in the Bible wearing. So there's sort of that the shirt that you wear, and then there's the coat. According to the Old Testament law, you were not allowed to take someone's outer coat in a lawsuit. So maybe you failed to repay someone's debt, or they need some kind of article, some kind of item as security to say, okay, I need some kind of a down payment or some kind of security for you to repay the debt. The law of God in Exodus 22 says you may not take that outer cloak because, hey, for the poor man, that's not only his clothes, but that's also his blanket, that's also his pillow, that's also kind of his most basic necessity. Under the law, you are under no obligation to ever give up your outer coat, translated here, cloak. So what Jesus is saying is, here you are being sued in a state of poverty. Most early Christians were in a place of poverty. Here you are being sued by some kind of penny-pinching money lender who's like, I'm going to get my stuff back, and I'm willing to take the shirt off your back. I'm going to literally sue the clothes off your back for the cause of Christ because you're in a place of poverty, because you're in this place of being vulnerable. You might have the right to insist, no, my legal right is to do X, Y, or Z. Jesus says, you're willing to let that go. The point here is you are more concerned with generosity. You are more concerned with being like Jesus than you are in insisting on your own rights. You are more concerned with winning your enemy to Jesus than you are at beating him at his own game. Now, this doesn't mean that there are no limits. Again, Jesus is saying this very baldly and very directly, understanding that his readers would know, okay, there's qualifications, there's other things that the Bible says. This is not the only thing the Bible says on this topic. For example, when Jesus was before the high priest, he did protest his mistreatment. Likewise, when Paul was arrested in Philippi, he came back to them and says, okay, how is this legal that you guys have imprisoned me? I'm a Roman citizen. Okay, he was willing to call up the illegality of what was happening and the injustice of what was happening. But the point is, in both of those cases, it wasn't because this is unpleasant for me and let me try to turn the law around on my enemy. It was a concern for the injustice and the upholding of the law. What do we take away from this? It's not that you literally roll over and play dead and become a doormat whenever you are challenged. That's not the point. The point, rather, is I step back and say, faithfulness to the mission of Jesus is of more importance than me insisting upon my rights. For Paul, him calling for his rights actually furthered the gospel. that allowed him to continue preaching the gospel. He was like, you know what? It'd be akin to you saying today, someone's trying to tell you you can't give the gospel. You're like, the First Amendment gives me the right to do this, and it allows the gospel to be furthered. Your concern in that moment is not, my rights are violated, but your concern in that moment is, I want the gospel to continue going forward. So Jesus is not forbidding legal redress here. Rather, he is saying, when you're persecuted, you show love and kindness to your enemies, as we read earlier, so that you can overcome evil with good. He says, you hold your possessions loosely, that if giving up your possessions is required for the gospel, is required for the cause of Christ, you willingly let them go. Think of the example of Randy Alcorn. He was arrested for protesting abortion at an abortion clinic. And in the course of the law case, the judgment was that he would have to donate a large portion of his income to the abortion provider. And Randy Alcorn, being a Christian, said, I cannot in good conscience ever do that. They said, the only exception is if your income is below a certain level, like $20,000 a year or something that was really quite restrictive. And he said, because I in good conscience can never give a penny to that organization, I am voluntarily, so to speak, going to take a vow of poverty. And has lived the rest of his life living below that income level so he wouldn't have to do that. You say, that is an unjust judgment that's given to him. Right? And it seems unjust that he has to give up his income. Yet he's saying the cause of Christ and being faithful to Jesus is more important than my stuff. So you see, you don't just take this and apply it literally. They sued me for my income. I'm going to give all of my money to Planned Parenthood. That's not the application here. The application is my possessions I hold loosely, and obedience to the cause of Christ is more important than my stuff, more important than my rights. Powerful. The goal is not to win the case. The goal is to win the sinner. What about unreasonable demands? We come to verse 41. And whoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Unreasonable demands. The backdrop here is the Roman occupation of Palestine. The word that's translated compel has a technical meaning. The Greek language borrowed it from Persian, because during the Persian period they had their sort of famous post roads, and they've got to get letters down the road. So they're coming, it's like the Pony Express. They come to your house and say, the king's business requires that we have your horse, and they would requisition your horse and off gallop down the road to deliver the letter for the king. And so this word came to mean to requisition, to press into service, to force, to compel. So it'd be like the policeman coming and putting his badge in your window saying, I need your car to go and chase down the bad guy. The idea here is government force compelling you to do something you probably don't really want to do. I don't want to give up my car. I don't want to give up my horse. So by the Roman period, this referred to the right of a Roman soldier in occupied territory to require any individual in that territory to carry his gear and his backpack for 1 mile. You're carrying all your junk around, you got this huge backpack, and you see some hapless peasant on the roadside, and you say, you're carrying my stuff 1 mile. Well, if you're a Jewish person with any sense of national pride, that is incredibly degrading. Every step of that 5,280 feet, you're thinking, man, I long for the day that these worthless Romans are gone. And if there's no one looking, I want to see if I can take this guy's sword and stick him. That would be the natural impulse to me. This is so humiliating. I hate this. I despise this. The force of Caesar sort of coming to bear on my life in a very real, tangible way. And I had stuff I needed to do right now. I would rather use this mile, this time that's required carrying this guy's stuff for a mile, to go farm my own field. It is an unreasonable and an unjust demand. So what does Jesus say when you're faced with unjust and unreasonable demands from Caesar? Whoever shall compel thee to go a mile, overthrow the government. No. Go with him twain. What? Goes counter to sort of everything within our natural fiber to say, we want to resist and fight. Jesus says, go with him twain. So the illustration is coercive force calling you to do something you don't really want to do. You might have a modern example, right? Anybody here love paying your taxes? Anyone's like, yes, tax season, patriotic duty. Like, no, nobody enjoys that. as you kind of grit your teeth and like pay at the last possible moment. Like, we don't enjoy that. Or following laws, Congress passes some law that you're like, this is a boneheaded law, I don't get it, it doesn't make any sense, I'm not going to follow it. Or if some federal agency comes along in your business of work and they come up with some new rules and regulations that you're like, what? When you're called to do things you find intrusive, oppressive, irritating. Now, we're not talking about something that is unrighteous. Okay? We obey God rather than man when that happens. But carrying the Roman soldier's backpack, paying the taxes, following the regulations, obeying laws that I don't really like. Personally, I'm not a big fan of speed limits. Okay, like, just be transparent here with you. Jesus says, don't settle for doing the bare minimum with gritted teeth. Now, if we were being overly literal here, you would say, well, therefore we should pay double taxes. This is not meant to be a mathematical formula, do double of everything you're required. The point here is have a heart that willingly and joyfully obeys, because you're not ultimately obeying Caesar, you're obeying Christ. That's the point. Again, we're making a mistake, we're misinterpreting if we turn these all into sort of precise mathematical formulas like never defend yourself or always pay double. Like, that's not the point. The point is don't settle for doing the bare minimum. Go the second mile. The issue is not the distance, but the disposition of the heart. If you sort of took this overly literally, you would say, well, you go 1 mile and then measure out exactly another 5,280 feet and just continue trudging along and then drop the backpack. And I'm like, that's still not meeting what Jesus is requiring. He's not saying pay double on your taxes, but not a penny more. He's not saying clock in for 40 hours, but actually work 80 hours. That's not what he is saying. He is saying do the unpleasant things with a submissive heart, because you're ultimately doing it for me. You're ultimately doing it as my representative. Don't grudgingly and angrily do the bare minimum, but go above and beyond what is required, because your heart is submitted to God's purposes, not your own. Romans 13 talks about our relationship to government. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. Why? There is no authority but God's. And the powers that be are ordained of God. So when I choose to pay my taxes, I'm not just doing it because I'm afraid the IRS will come after me if I don't. I'm paying my taxes because I'm submitting to a higher king, a higher authority. I'm submitting to King Jesus. That's why Peter in 1 Peter 2, he says, you obey the government as someone who is free. You're not a slave of the state. No, you are free, and you're doing this voluntarily out of love for Jesus. That's a totally different way. It changes the way, like, man, it's almost April 15th. That changes the way that you approach your taxes, to be like, I can pay my taxes as an act of worship to Jesus. I can drive the speed limit out of worship to Jesus. Let's just kind of extrapolate this a little bit more. Going to work, just kind of on a more granular level, where you're called upon to do things that aren't always tons of fun. In fact, most of the things we do for 40 hours a week are pretty monotonous and repetitive. It is easy to do your job at work like you're sweeping sand at the beach, right? You're like, this is pointless, and I'm just going to kind of go along, and I'm going to just go the bare mile. You know how a Christian approaches his job? He approaches his job as recognizing, I'm not ultimately working for a paycheck, I'm working for Jesus. Colossians 3 gives us this example. Colossians 3 has this amazing statement, verse 22, servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers. He says, don't just do it when the boss is looking, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. And whatever ye do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. That's what Jesus is driving at with the second mile. It applies in your relationship to government. It applies with how you do your job. Knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. Do it for Jesus. You ever go into, you know, customer service at Walmart, and everybody who is working there has the mentality of, that's not my job. Right, my job description is to move this box from here. Sorry, if you're asking me where the milk is, I'm not going to help you. The Christian does not have that mentality. The Christian does not have the mentality of, let me do the bare minimum at my job or the bare minimum in my duty in other relationships. When you're doing that spreadsheet at work, you're doing that for Christ. When you're starting that IV, you're doing it for Christ. When you're welding those sheets of metal together, You're doing it for Christ. When you're pulling Romex through the wall, you're doing it for Jesus. When you're paying your taxes or following the law or driving your car, you're doing it for Christ. And so even when there are unjust or even unreasonable demands that are put upon us, and I have the extra mile mentality, disposition of heart. Now, caveat here, I do believe that if you have the ability to go to HR, that I've got a boss who's being really, really unreasonable and asking me to do things that aren't within the job description or what I'm being paid for, or you have the ability through the ballot box or writing letters to your congressman to change unjust laws and to change things that aren't efficient or making sense, by all means do that. I think Christian stewardship would call us to do that. But in all of it, we have an attitude of submission to Christ. You see, the Christian's testimony is promoted when you live differently than the rest. The first mile, you're walking with the Roman soldier, he's saying, well, you're just like every other peasant who does this because he has to. But when he's like, all right, your mile's up, you can put the backpack down, you say, no, I'll go with you the second mile. At that point, that Roman soldier is thinking, this Jewish peasant is different than every other Jewish peasant I've met. What is different about you? When you're the one guy at work who does your job and goes above and beyond and doesn't argue and complain and whine about it, at some point people will be like, why are you doing that? When your response to government authorities is not one of, well, I'm just gonna grit my teeth and be in an attitude of resentment and rage under things that I don't like, that is no different than the way that the lost respond. We want to live in a way that people look at you and say, you're different. Why do you live like that? So that we have an opportunity to give an answer to the one who asks of us. But finally, in verse 42, we see Jesus' teaching on how we respond to beggars and borrowers. Verse 42, give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. This is calling us to a generous heartedness. Again, have you seen the principle all the way through this? Is the attitude is not, let me do the bare minimum that required by the law. Let me interpret this and find out what my least amount of duty is. That the mentality here is rather an eye for an eye, or what can I get out of it, is how can I be faithful to Christ? This is calling you to an attitude of generosity. Now, again, this is not meant to be the Bible's sum total teaching on everything related to finances and how we care for the poor. I think it would be a mistake to say this is, the only thing you need to know about financial management is just give everything away to everyone who asks. Okay, you'll be broke really fast. The book of Proverbs does warn against who you give loans to, right? Like, don't be surety for a stranger. Don't give loans to, like, be wise in how you steward your money. This is not saying erasing all of that. Don't pit Jesus against the Bible, okay? This is not to be pitted against 1st or 2nd Thessalonians as if someone doesn't work, neither should he eat. This is not to be pitted against, hey, let's go reward laziness and addiction. No. Those things stand on their own. The point here is have an attitude of generosity to people who come to you who are in genuine need. So the idea of give to him that asketh of thee is a beggar who is absolutely destitute, somebody with a real, genuine need who is dependent on other people's kindness to be able to survive or make it through. Okay, so this is not the professional beggar who's just gotten really good at shaking people down. Right, that's not who Jesus has in mind here. He's picturing in his society people who, through circumstances, through the oppression of the system, through their lot in life, are condemned to a state of being desolate and destitute. There is no bottom rung to the ladder in the ancient world. If you're born in the bottom of the heap, you stay on the bottom of the heap. They give to him that would borrow of thee. This is someone who has fallen on tough times and they need a hand up. They need, hey, can I get a short-term loan from you so that I can buy seed to plant the field for the next harvest? The point here is, how do you respond to those needs that come up around you? No, we're not called to fund every drug addict's habit or support the professional con artist. But we should have an attitude of genuine generosity to those who are in need. Because there's two principles that I think can guide us here. One of them I'm going to call the stewardship principle. When you come at generosity with an eye for an eye mentality, you think, I'm only going to give money to someone if in some way they can kind of come back around to help me. Right? I'm going to give them money so hopefully one day they can give me money. That's the eye for an eye mentality. A stewardship mentality says, there is no such thing as my money. It is all God's money. And it's my job to manage it in a way that is pleasing to him. So God gives you money so to meet your needs and the needs of your family, and he gives you money as well so that you can be generous to people who come to you in need. The stewardship mentality says, this is not mine, it is all his. And Jesus, in this point, would be generous to the person standing in front of me. It's not our tendency to tenaciously cling to everything that we consider to be mine. My time, my resources, my money, my job, mine. Jesus is saying, no, that's not the way to think. The way to think is, it's all a gift, it's all on loan from God. Use it for his honor and for his glory. So when it comes to generosity, we never ask, what's in it for me? You think, well, I'll give to this person, and then there'll be some, I'll have the satisfaction of being able to look good on the Instagram post that I'm going to make about this. By the way, if you ever go on a missions trip, don't use the people on the missions trip as props for your photos. It's so dehumanizing. Don't treat good works as an opportunity to toot your own horn, to be like, here's this homeless guy that I just gave money to, and let me go post it. No, you don't do this to be seen of men. That's the next chapter. But doing it simply out of a heart of generosity because God has given to you. The second principle that guides us in responding to beggars and borrowers is what I'm going to call the love principle. It's the principle that says, I am going to show love to the people who are in front of me. I'm going to love my neighbor as myself. I'm going to give to the person in abject poverty to help them make it through another day. I'm going to give this loan to an individual to help them get through a tough time. By the way, if giving a loan is a good thing, taking a loan is not necessarily a sin. Jesus is saying, is not actually saying anything new here. If you read the Old Testament was clear that you leave the edges of the fields for the poor to come and eat. There was actually a tax, if you will, a tithe that was paid for the maintenance of the poor. What we call today welfare was in ancient Israel. There were systems that were in place to protect and to provide for the very poor in the land. And the righteous man, according to Psalm 37, is one who is generous in heart and in giving. Galatians 6:10 says, do good to all men, as you're able, do good to all. It's a general responsibility to people we meet, especially those of the household of faith, starting right here at the church. Start closest at home. The love principle would also give me the limit for the kind of generosity that I show. Because some people would read, give to him that asks of thee, and so everyone who comes along I better help and provide for. And then, as a result, you end up teaching people to be lazy or to continue funding a bad habit rather than going out and working and that sort of thing. There is a kind of generosity that is well-intentioned but is actually unloving. Let me define love for you. Love is seeking the ultimate good of another person, even at great expense to myself. Me giving money to someone so they can go buy their next fix of drugs is not loving. That is enabling destructive behavior. It's not loving for a parent to give the toddler everything they ask for. If we were to just take this and be like, it's the only thing the Bible says, give them that ask of thee. Well, the two-year-old has demanded cream puffs for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so we'll give it to him. No, that's not loving, right? It's not loving to give something that is harmful and damaging to someone. So we've got to use discernment here. The motivation and the limitation of our generosity is genuine love. So love is what drives me to say, I want to give. But it's also love that says, let me give in a way that is going to be truly helpful to this person. So sometimes the wise thing to do is not to give cash, but to help someone get a ride to a job interview. Sometimes the loving thing is not to give someone a car, but to give them a lesson on how to maintain their car. Sometimes it's not giving the man a fish, but teaching him how to fish. It is motivated by genuine love. With all those qualifications in place, though, recognizing, yes, there's sometimes it's not wise to give in the ways that people are demanding, and we've got to sort of discern, like, how's this going to be used? Will this actually help? Will this harm? I don't think the danger facing the conservative evangelical church today is being too generous. I really don't. I don't think if God were to evaluate the giving patterns in your life and my life, he would say, you're giving too much, stop, you're harming people by being too generous. I think probably our problem is being too stingy and too greedy and too self-absorbed with how we use our resources. You look over your spending for the last month. How much of your spending was driven by generosity? Giving money to support missions, giving money to take care of the widows and the fatherless and the immigrant? How much of your giving was just spontaneous? Your spending was spontaneous. Man, there's a need in front of me. Person's checking out and their credit card's getting declined. Trying to get the groceries for the week. If you're looking back over and you're like, man, there's just not much there. Maybe it's time to start planning your budget in a way to be like, I'm going to set aside money just to meet needs when God brings them across my path. To be ready to do that. All of this is a pretty crazy way to live. I think you would agree. I probably said things this morning that you have found offensive or disagreeable or go against sort of the way that you think about the world. The Bible is meant to challenge us, right? Jesus is saying things here that are meant to challenge the status quo, to challenge the natural way of thinking. He's challenging us to be odd about getting even. To say, I'm not going to retaliate. I'm not going to live life just for what I can get out of it, making sure that I'm okay. We're called to live for the glory of God. And the only way we can live this way is if we have been radically transformed by the one who did live this way perfectly. Jesus went to the cross bearing our reproach. Jesus went to the cross taking our shame. Jesus went to the cross so that he could generously and freely give forgiveness and mercy and kindness and eternal life to people like you and me who do not deserve us. And that is the model for how we live. Not to ask, well, does the person in front of me deserve my kindness or my love? Beloved, you did not deserve God's kindness or love. It's to be so transformed by the fact that he, rather than giving me the vengeance that I deserve from God, gave me mercy. Who among his own self bore our sins on the tree. Right? He has called us to follow in his steps. Let's bow together for prayer.